Deeply Black Perspective. That's Full Spectrum every Tuesday at 6 p.m. beginning August 4th, right here on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Candy Shannon, and you are tuned to Member Supported WPFW, Washington.
And welcome to WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. In this hour, it's We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. And for the listeners who are recently joining us, We the People is a one-hour interview news magazine in which we discuss issues related to the intersection of race, politics, history, and culture. There are things that have been done in the past by striking individuals and groups, but there are things that are going on presently with us trying to build a hopeful future since we are under the mandate of building a better world, one broadcast at a time. We're going to pursue the politics of hope with guest John Nichols. But before that, I'd like to remind regular, renewing, sustaining, and brand new listeners that we're in our summer fund drive. We have to make about $350,000 a quarter. So each quarter we come to you, it takes more than $100,000 a month. And my share of that responsibility is to exceed $500 in this hour. That may be done by 10 people, it may be done by 50 people. But you can do that by calling 1-800-222-9739, 1-800-222-9739, or click that bright red donate button at WPFWFM.org. And without further ado, let me introduce my guests. John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, as well as a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and he's the associate editor of The Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. He has written, co-written, or edited over a dozen books on topics ranging from the histories of American socialism and the Democratic Party to the analysis of U.S. and global media systems. These books include The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, and Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accounting for Those Who Caused the Crisis. His latest book is co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's okay to be angry about capitalism. So, John Nichols, I hope we're more than angry in discussion. And I welcome you to this morning's show. Thank you for being with us.
David, it's an honor to be with you. I'm so glad to be here.
These are de-changing times. For many people, they not only see the peril, but they see the promise and the challenges and opportunities ahead. I'll just start off. I'll get right into it. With this year of national elections and the events that have led to them, and we won't forget that worldwide, a lot of things are going on. Thanks to students everywhere, particularly in the Middle East and in Africa and in Asia, there's a lot of social changes. And observers believe that there's a convergence of movements that is a possible result of hard work that's already been done that will lead to transformational politics. How do you, or might you believe in this conclusion, and how would you define it further for us?
Sure. I think that's a very good question, David, or a good place to begin. The way to understand politics is this. Organizing is always going on. And sometimes it is incredibly successful and transformational in and of itself. And you think of the organizing of particular unions and other groupings, civil rights groupings that you know, really do, simply because of the hard work of the organizers, achieve a great deal and make things happen. But the other thing to understand is that sometimes organizing doesn't have an immediate impact, right? You keep at it because you want to build that base for the moment when the moment arrives, right? Well, what I would suggest to you is that for a variety of reasons, the moment has arrived. And we live at a time where we have been confronted by some overwhelming realities. We should never forget about, you know, what we went through 4 years ago, and that was COVID, right? COVID was a globally significant and transformational moment. It did a couple things. First off, it showed us that we were very vulnerable, right? That there are diseases out there and diseases, frankly, that could be much more severe than COVID that can sweep through the world for a variety of reasons. And we have to be prepared for that. We have to be on top of that. But it also showed us something else. And that is that in a crisis moment, government can respond in a very bold and effective way and get us through the worst of the crisis. And that's a big deal. You know, when Donald Trump was president, COVID hit, and Trump made a lot of mistakes. There's simply no question. He handled it very, very poorly. But one of the things that happened during that period was that suddenly the Republicans in Congress, as well as Democrats, decided to become social Democrats, right? They suddenly are spending money like crazy. We didn't have any money for anything, right? And everybody's talking about going broke, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly we had this huge rush of spending to shore up businesses, to shore up human beings, to make sure that families are stabilized, to help people pay their rent. They delayed paying taxes even, right? Because, you know, people wanted to have that space. And then when Trump went out after really bumbling a lot of the crisis, Biden came in, handled a lot of the crisis better, also continued a great deal of that social spending, at least initially in that first year. What that showed us is that as a society, this is just the United States, obviously other countries had different approaches, but it did show us that we can do big things. We can solve huge problems. We can make people's lives dramatically better. And we don't have to wait for a disease to do it, right? And so that's where we are today. We're in this great debate, right? And organizers, people, progressives are saying we can do a lot more. Obviously, our Republican friends are often saying we can't, but there's been an opening here that creates opportunities. And I think because of all the organizing that's gone on up to this point, on raising wages to $15, $17, even $20 an hour, on extending care to people who need it, on child tax credits, on all these different issues, we're at a point where if you can, you know, win some victories, taking on corporations and win some elections, an awful lot is possible.
Allow a small annotation. At least initially, there was no whining, fussing, or conjuring of the threat of debt and how we couldn't get out of it. People acted, I'd like to think, beyond just mere reflex, perhaps a decency of humanity, a solidarity of humanity, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I'll push it even further. If, dare I say, something that smacks of globalism, but we're interdependent, we're interlocked. You know?
Yeah, and this goes, I think, David, you're exactly right. And this goes back to a lot of our history, right? At its best, in the New Deal era, wasn't perfect. There were plenty of errors, plenty of missteps, plenty of things that should have been done differently. But at its best, during the New Deal, there was a sense that when a problem arrived, you figured out a way to deal with it, right? And you didn't necessarily ask how much it cost to deal with it. You basically said, look, there are human beings who are suffering. There is a Great Depression. There is the threat of fascism in Europe. There are all these challenges coming at us. We're not going to go to the accountants first, right? We're going to go to the people that build things and make things happen. We're going to try and figure out how to empower them and how to strengthen them with unions, with policies, you know, industrial policy, things of that nature. And also with an extension of civil rights. Remember, the New Deal was deeply imperfect as regards civil rights. And yet when A. Philip Randolph, a great organizer for out of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, went to Franklin Roosevelt and said, look, if you don't integrate the war industries, we're going to march on Washington. That was in 1941. Roosevelt said, okay, I get it. We're going to do it. And so there suddenly you had a major breakthrough in a very challenging moment. And give Roosevelt the credit. He didn't let ideology or, you know, kind of crass politics get in the way of doing the right thing. You saw a similar thing after the war, after World War II with Harry Truman. Again, A. Philip Randolph threatened to march on Washington in 1948 if they didn't integrate the military. And Truman said, oh, better do it. And he integrated the military. And so what you see is this sort of intersection throughout our history of organizing, activism, and then when the moment comes, a demand. And if I have any criticism of the left at this point, is that sometimes the demands aren't big enough, right? There are the genius of A. Philip Randolph was that he made great big demands at critical junctures and got them. We've seen some folks who do it brilliantly in this period. And I look at what the UAW did with its big strike. I've looked at, you know, a number of other actions, but this is a time to make big demands. Democratic Party will meet in Chicago next week, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But you know, there will be marches in the streets, people saying, look, we've got to end the horror, the nightmare of the Israeli assault on Gaza. There has to be a ceasefire. There'll be folks who say, oh, don't do that because you got to have unity and stuff like this. A. Philip Randolph didn't play that game. Neither did a lot of the most brilliant organizers throughout history. What they said was, look, you can get unity really quick by doing the right thing. And I think that those who march in Chicago are saying that. They're saying, look, at this point, it looks like Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are doing really, really well. They appear to be in a position where they could well win in November. But a narrow win is not sufficient. They have to win big. I mean, this has to be transformational if you're going to really move the needle on governing. And so how do you get that? You build out the biggest possible coalition. How do you build out the biggest possible coalition? You take a serious look at those policies and those actions that you've taken, which are not popular with a lot of people. And you say, maybe we ought to do that which is A, morally right, and ending the violence is morally right, but B, popular, right? Because that combination can create a politics that is, I would dare say, joyful, and also potentially very successful.
Indeed. I'm going to have to be the meddlesome wrongful advocate just for a nanosecond. You mentioned the Democratic National Convention going on next week. Oh. Grassroots protesters, here's the word, grasping my pearls here, even though I don't wear them. No, they're in contention with being able to protest and speaking up and speaking loudly within sight and sound of the convention. Right now, I believe it's in court that they're several blocks away. I imagine if one were in the convention center in Chicago, you would not hear or possibly even see these protesters.
Yeah, and that's right.
And
that's
it's these micro things that are meddlesome, but sure. And I understand you're doing the bigger picture. I get it.
I'm with you, David. And look, but here's the subtlety of it. That's why we have a media. At our best, our media makes that linkage, right? That the people who are inside a convention see that there are demonstrations outside because those demonstrations are covered. That's why it is so important to cover dissent, right? Covering the festivity of a convention is one thing, right? I mean, that's easy. You turn your camera on, there you go. Yeah. Covering dissent, covering the debate, that's harder, but it is just as important. And I'll give you a good example of this. In 1968, which many Democrats fear that year 1968, they say, oh my gosh, Chicago, 1968. It is in fact true that 1968 was a year much like this one. We had a Democratic president who was involved in foreign policy activities that were unpopular. That Democratic president faced a lot of internal party strife. That president chose to stand down, not seek re-election, to hand off the nomination effectively to his vice president. That vice president then went into a convention in Chicago. Sound familiar? It's every, you know, all these steps here, right? And so, but here is the interesting twist on it. In Chicago, a lot of the history now says, oh, well, the big problem in Chicago was the demonstrations in the streets. The demonstrations in the streets of Chicago were intense. There are a lot of them. The police pushback against them was violent and over the top. But at the end of the day, those demonstrations in Chicago were not bigger or more significant than demonstrations in many cities across the whole country that year and in the year before. Remember, that was the year when the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot. That was the year when Bobby Kennedy was shot. That was the year when people felt an incredible level of turbulence and uncertainty and challenge. And there were demonstrations all over the country, right? Happened that there were some of those demonstrations in Chicago. That wasn't the issue. The issue was that inside the convention hall, the Democratic Party didn't change. Instead of adopting an anti-Vietnam War plank, instead of making a clear break with the Johnson administration and giving Humphrey the chance to run as a fundamental alternative, right? Not just to the Republicans, Richard Nixon, and to the independent George Wallace, but also to the Democratic Party's mistakes and its errors, right? If Humphrey had made that change, if the convention had made, you know, even a modest adjustment on Vietnam policy, Humphrey would have won the election. And here's a big deal. Having won that election with a Democratic Congress, he could have carried on the war against poverty. He could have extended the advances in the civil rights movement that had occurred under Johnson. I mean, it's sort of an endless array of things that could have been done. And so, you know, when we look back at it, the lesson is very clear. Making a smart adjustment on policy, particularly on a foreign policy where the U.S. is wrong, making that smart adjustment can have profound impact, not just in one election, but on the whole history of the United States. Okay? And if you say, well, yeah, but that's awful. 1952, when we were in the midst of the Korean War, Dwight Eisenhower, running as a Republican, a former general or, you know, former commander of U.S. forces during World War II in Europe, Dwight Eisenhower said, I will go to Korea and settle this thing. And you know what he did after getting elected? He did, in fact, you know, dial down U.S. involvement in Korea. We still kept troops there, and it's ongoing. There are many things to debate about that. But the reality was that hot war was dialed down. And so the fact of the matter is that you can take an anti-war stance, you can take a pro-peace stance, win the American people, and then actually implement in a way that makes the world a better place. That lesson was lost in 68, and Democrats lost. I don't necessarily think Democrats will lose this year, no matter what. I think Democrats actually are on a real roll, and there's a very good chance that Harris and Walz will win, you know, on the basis just of their being the clear and appealing, in many ways, alternative to Donald Trump. But if you want to win big enough to actually have a transformational governance, then you should be thinking about all of these things. And one of the things you should be thinking about is a different policy on Gaza.
You know, this may be a good occasion to give you an occasion. You were here in Washington, D.C. recently at the Henry A. Wallace event that was put on by the Nation and the Institute for Policy Studies. And John Nichols, I get it about you and I both share a reverence for movement, groups, systems and structures that reflect real human beings. I get it. But what did Mr. Henry Wallace, one-time vice president under FDR, what does he exemplify, particularly his challenge to the Democratic Party?
That's a wonderful question, David. Look, Henry Wallace was, he was a Republican through much of his life, and then a 1924 supporter of the independent progressive candidacy of Robert M. La Follette for president. But he basically remained a Republican. Roosevelt reached out to him and said, look, I need you on my team because you are a progressive Republican. Wallace got that, joined the Roosevelt administration. He was one of the four people that was a member of the Roosevelt cabinet from the beginning to the end, from 1933 to 1945. And but in 1940, Franklin Roosevelt was recognizing the threat of fascism in Europe, the need to unite the United States against fascism. And he looked around in his cabinet and he said, who is the person who can really do, you can really build on our ticket and make this a powerful ticket going into this very challenging time? So he elevated Henry Wallace to the vice presidency. Henry Wallace seized on that opportunity, and it was an interesting thing. Wallace refused to simply be, you know, the fifth wheel, right, or whatever a vice president is. He chose to add value to the Roosevelt administration. The value that he added, among other things, in many issues, was an absolute commitment to civil rights. This is someone who wanted to end segregation, wanted to end the violence of Jim Crow in America, not somewhere down the line, but in that immediate moment.
And he actually took himself and went south.
Oh, later. In his presidency. Yeah. But the most, yes, and he did some during his vice presidency. The most classic thing he did, David, was in 1943, there was a so-called race riot in Detroit. Race riot is a misnomer, right? What you're really talking about is a situation where Southern blacks had come north to work in the defense industries, had come work to work in the factories. There were racist elements that sought to, you know, oppose that, to try and undermine that, to divide, to sow divisions. And you did have violence in Detroit where people got killed in 1943. This was not, you know, this wasn't the fault of black people. This was targeting black people by white racists and by police forces that did terrible violence. And at that point, it would have been very, very easy for Henry Wallace to do what most other politicians did, look away, right? Say, oh, there's a problem in Detroit. You know, hope you sort that out. No, he flew to Detroit in 1943, organized a rally with the United Auto Workers, a multiracial, multi-ethnic rally, in which he said, the violence that we are fighting against in Europe, fascism, is reflected in the violence of racism here in America, right? That's separating people based on the color of their skin, their religion, whatever. And this is an incredibly bold and challenging speech in the midst of a war. He was attacked by the New York Times. He was attacked by Democratic political leaders. They actually tried to marginalize him within the administration. Why? Because he said, we ought to fight fascism abroad and at home. And that was the kind of vice president he was. And he carried that through his journey. He was an anti-racist, anti-fascist political leader in this country at a critical juncture, and the Democratic Party rejected him. They worked very hard to push him out, to their shame, and frankly, to the great disadvantage of the United States, because if Henry Wallace had succeeded to the presidency in 1945, as would have happened if he had remained as vice president, if he had succeeded the presidency, I think we would have confronted issues of racism and sexism much sooner. Decades sooner. Doesn't mean we would have succeeded easily. It would have been hard, maybe even, you know, an overwhelming challenge, but we would have been confronting it.
And long, doing the work by his example and actions.
Yeah. And also, look at that. You tell me, 20 years earlier?
Would have made a great
difference. Take it down Jim Crow? Sure. Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. It's a big deal in policy, but it's also a human reality. People's lives are made fundamentally better. So, as a society, I think we missed a chance there. And I always teach the lesson of Henry Wallace, or try to teach the lesson of Henry Wallace, a flawed man who made many mistakes, as we all do, right? And many reasons to criticize him, blah, blah, blah. But the simple lesson is that when you push aside anti-racist, anti-fascist leaders, when you push aside bold leaders who really are trying to move the needle, that is a very damaging thing, I think, to society. And we ought to keep that lesson in mind as we see challenges to Democratic members of Congress who oppose U.S. policy in Gaza. And some incumbents have been beaten in primaries recently by a huge inflow of money, because of their stance for a ceasefire. Although I will note that last night in Minneapolis, Ilhan Omar, an initial sponsor of the ceasefire resolution, someone who has been absolutely clear on these issues, Ilhan Omar didn't just win her Democratic primary. She's running against the same guy who just 2 years ago came within 2 points of beating her. Last night, she won by 14 points, a huge landslide victory. So taking the right stand on Gaza is both good policy and good politics if you don't have this massive spending against you.
Listeners, we are talking to John Nichols, the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, contributing writer for The Progressive in these times. And John, important to me is that you're the associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, as well. You're listening to We the People. We're talking about pursuing the politics of hope, but we can only do that by your support. It is important that listeners hear me out, knowing that we're in our summer fund drive. We need your pledges and your membership to keep this Jazz and Justice station going. An anonymous donor in Bethesda has got us going. I need to get you to help me raise over $500 so we can meet our goal quarter to quarter. It is the listeners that sustain us in our entirety. That is no joke. It is a real thing. It's been done for 47 plus years. Thank you, listeners. You can become a sustaining member, which can help you give within your means by calling 1-800-222-9739. 1-800-222-9739.
For those who might be listening, they can go to the website.
And I'm about to say that, Miyuki Williams. Thank you. And I was just about to say that they can click the bright red button that says donate at WPFWFM.org. Again, the bright red button that says donate at WPFWFM.org. And there's a third way. Some of our listeners listen on smartphones. If you have the Cash App application, $WPFW. So there's three different ways to give.
$WPFWFM.
FM. Thank you. Good catch. $WPFWFM on Cash App. And so, I want to give people a reason why. One of the themes that John Nichols has talked about is the media responsibility. I'm sure we're going to get back to that accountability in the program. But if you listen to WPFW throughout the week, you get things like Voices with Visions, On the Ground, Africa Now, and Reverend Yearwood on Friday mornings with environmental concerns. All those shows deal with grassroots efforts. They amplify the voices that you want to hear and the reason you come to WPFW. Become a sustainer of that kind of media today. Again, 1-800-222-9739. John Nichols, back to you, and thank you.
Hey, let me just break here and say, giving those donations is a really big deal. People really ought to do it. I'm not saying I'm bringing anything great here at all, but I will tell you that if you listen to that first half hour that we just did, where we're talking about Gaza and, this history of fighting racism and fascism and the contemporary moment, all the things that are going on, You're not going to hear that in a lot of other places in media, right? So if you want to amplify a critique that is rooted in David's brilliant show and in all of the programs here, if you want to amplify that critique and make sure that perspective is heard in these times, then you have to give to this station. You can't just say, oh yeah, I'm in favor of progressive media, or I like the fact that Democracy Now! Exists. I like the fact that The Nation exists. I do too. Actual bricks and mortar radio station that is doing the work right now. And so people need to donate. And don't hold off for the rest of the show. Do it now. Don't make people beg at the end of the show for a couple extra dollars. Give now and make that call. And David's going to repeat the phone number and all the details one more time, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay, 1-800-222-9739, 1-800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org, and for Cash App users, $WPFWFM. Thank you, John Nichols, for guests like you. You know, I've had your Nation colleagues, Ellie Mistal, Jeet Hare, and a number of others here, and they are more than happy to give their unique perspective, and quite frankly, very well informed, better than mainstream media, not only opinion, but they give us a picture of what's going on. So I urge listeners again to support the station. You know, you're talking about a couple of different aspects here of how politics really does matter, that it's not mere results or outcomes, that it really affects our lives. And I even feel it under your influence and the influence of others. We're seeming to break through what political scientists amorally call the Overton window. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to describe that because it might give some, not all listeners, a frame here, that it's an approach to identifying like what ideas on the that fit on a spectrum of acceptability to govern. And I sometimes question whether it's purpose to govern as much as it's the purpose to survive. And the sad application, possibly a misapplication, is that politicians will only do what they think is safe, plausible, and at least temporarily viable. And the mistake made is, sometimes we think that the politicians are expanding that window or moving it about or causing the shift. I think the first half hour has given a good demonstration that it's the people that continue and struggle, the theme of our fund drive, that the struggle continues, that creates the shift. And you were talking about Henry Wallace. Even as one person, he knew that he was attached and accountable to many people. Mm-hmm. So, is there an inside game, an outside game in political participation, particularly party politics?
Of course there is. Yeah, absolutely. You know, don't leave any avenue unexplored, right?
Right.
And what I would say to you is, look, we're always looking for the way to move the needle, right? And sometimes that is going to be as simple as writing a letter to the editor or calling into a radio show or, you know, going knocking on doors in your neighborhood or going to a march or, you know what I mean? You can say all of these things that you can do. And
John, keep going. You're frozen for a moment, folks. We'll be right with you. John, keep going. Yeah, why don't you do that? We'll give you a public service announcement and be right back.
Oh, yeah. Hey, friends, we are back again. Mark your calendars. On Saturday, August the 24th, WPFW will host the 15th annual Blues Festival featuring Clarence the Blues Man Turner, Jim Bennett with Jesse Terrell, Stacy Brooks, Low Rent Quartet, Reggie Right Eye, and the Missing Pieces, all at Lamont's Entertainment Complex, 4400 Livingston Road in Indian Head, Maryland. Event time is from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. For more information, go to eventbrite.com and search WPFW. Why, you ask? Because WPFW is building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Believe that.
From Rahsaan Roland Kirk to Assata Shakur, WPFW has been your go-to for cultural and political education since 1977. Your contributions have allowed us to uphold the mission of liberatory media set forth by our founders. August 11th through the 24th presents another opportunity to support WPFW during our summer pledge drive. Donations can also be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Equal Portions is delighted to join Jazz and Justice Radio, WPFW, every Monday at 1 p.m. beginning August 5th. We're talking everything food justice, interviewing folks across all sectors, and playing the hottest new DMV music with your host, Sasha Lamira.
Hey, y'all. On Equal Portions, we'll be discussing all aspects of the way we interact with food, from the problems affecting our communities to the history and the story of the food around us and the local individuals within the food community. That's Equal Portions, Mondays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Every Thursday morning, from 2 to 5 a.m., Spirits Free Radio, hosted by DJ M, presents a variety of jazz music, from free and spiritual, to cool and smooth, to groovy and funky. That's Spirits Free Radio, every Thursday, 2 to 5 a.m., WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, John Nichols, the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, is with us. We're pursuing the politics of hope, even through technical difficulties. And while that was going on, some anonymous friends in Washington, D.C. have put us over our $500 goal for the hour. But I'd like to respectfully ask listeners to keep it going, because 1 hour may make some of its goal, another hour may exceed it, but we all need to work together. Many, if you're
absolutely, you see my trick there. See my ingenious move. I caused technical a chance to call in and give donations. Right. So maybe the answer is to have technical difficulties on a regular basis.
I hope not. But
I hope people keep calling. I hope people keep calling.
That 1-800-222-9739, or click the bright red donate button at WPFWFM.org. You know, I'll jump into something because I think this is an essential element. Go ahead. You were about to say something.
I was just going to finish the quick thought that I was on before we broke off. And if you recall, you asked a very brilliant question about the inside-outside strategies, activism on the streets and activism with political parties. And what I was saying was that, I like a multi-party democracy, and I understand sometimes you're going to have third-party challenges and alternatives. And I think all of this, we respect every effort to engage politically. But one thing I'll tell you right now is that there's a lot of energy going into the Democratic Party. And I think that energy is coming because you saw a shift in the ticket, right? You have Kamala Harris and Tim Walz now at the top of the ticket. And polling suggests that this combination is working very well. And a lot of people, especially a lot of young people, are getting engaged politically. And all I would say about that is, great. It's good to be engaged politically. And when you come into a political party, come as your whole self, right? Come as who you are and bring your politics with you. And so if you're excited about, where the Democratic Party is going today, that's fine. But don't think that you have to, simply jump on board without asking questions or adding your ideas. It's okay to say, wow, I hope these people win, but I hope they win running on these issues, or I hope they emphasize these positions. And so I guess what I would say about political engagement, you know, political party engagement, is that it should never simply be as, you know, a cheerleader, right? Or as a, you know, somebody says, oh, I love whatever this party does. It's much more useful and much more valuable to come as somebody who says, look, I understand the importance of this particular party winning or that particular party winning, but I want to make sure that they do it right. They run on the issues that matter, and that they actually move this country toward economic and social and racial justice, toward saving the planet, and toward peace.
Well, John Nichols, you just set up another good question. I'm going to take the role here. Whenever I sit with you and talk to you, whether it's on the air or in person, again, media responsibility, media accountability, and it's been very frustrating to think through, I don't like to make false enemies, but through mainstream media presentation, that people are just voting or acting politically, reflexively, emotionally, on mere impressions, rah, rah, rah for my team, boo, boo, boo for theirs. Mm-hmm. And what you just said, which I'd like you to further extend, is that people are indeed measuring and taking actions differently. We need to respect their own, not only their own identity, but their own place in community. And I was hoping that in some way you could verify that. For instance, there's a lot of upset in your state of Wisconsin. There's a battle over two constitutional referendums going on. If you could describe to us that there's more than just a surface picture as far as, again, pursuing hope in politics.
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. And that's you brought up a very good example of where this is all at. Because in Wisconsin, where I live, it's a great battleground state. Of the last six presidential elections, four of them have been decided by under 25,000 votes. So both national presidential campaigns put an immense amount of energy into Wisconsin. Just last week, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz were in Eau Claire, and so was J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance is going to be back in Wisconsin on Friday, and I suspect that all of the major candidates will be in Wisconsin again probably in the next week and a half, 2 weeks. So, I mean, this is where the thing is fought out. And the interesting thing is that the needle is moving in Wisconsin. There's no question that Wisconsin is becoming a more Democratic state. In the last two gubernatorial elections, elected a Democratic governor. Last two attorney general elections, elected a Democratic attorney general. Democrats have had great success in Supreme Court races. They've now shifted the dynamic in the legislature. Very likely that this year you could have a narrowing of the Republican majority, perhaps even a shift to the Democrats in control of the legislature. So all sorts of things happening here. And the Republican response to that has been much, in Wisconsin, much like you see at the federal level, it is to be anti-small-D Democratic, i.e. to try and undermine Democratic processes so that the advancing, the growing movement, and I don't think the Democratic Party is always a movement party by any means, but in this case, many movements have linked to it, and it is on a rise, it looks to be, in the polls and in the results from elections around the country. The reaction of the Republicans to that is to try and shut things down, to try and undermine democracy, to try and prevent things from happening by attacks on voting rights, by attacks on civil rights, by attacks on election results, denial of election results, et cetera, et cetera. And in Wisconsin, we had these two constitutional amendments, which were designed to take away the power of the elected Democratic governor to distribute federal money. And this is money that's already been allocated, it's already been debated, there's already been a decision that this money is going to the state to be spent. And but instead of allowing the governor to spend that money for economic programs, for environmental programs, for disaster relief in urgent moments, instead of allowing that to happen, the Republicans said, oh, no, we want to take that power away from the governor and give it to the legislature.
Ourselves, in other words.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But a legislature that rarely meets, right, that has been accused of a lot of corruption, all sorts of problems, right? And they want to just, so it isn't really handing it to the full legislature for honest debates and immediate action. It's more likely handing it to legislative leaders, right, who are elected from one small district in the state, not statewide, but potentially could have immense power over billions in federal funding. It's a scam. It's a backroom deal. It's a scheme to, you know, upend the system of checks and balances and put power in the hands of people who the great mass of Wisconsin didn't choose, and who hold their power only because of gerrymandering, not because of honest election results. And, you know, they thought they were going to get away with it. They put a couple of referendums on the August ballot, which is usually very low turnout. It's an August primary ballot. Progressive groups organized, unions, progressive farmers, civil rights groups, community groups, the Democratic Party. And they made a big push to say vote no and no. Well, yesterday, roughly 58% of Wisconsinites voted no on both of those referendums. So the Republicans lost in their scheme, their backroom deal. Why that matters, of course, and why it's a very big deal is because that same coalition is a coalition that's headed toward November. And this primary election result, which, by the way, had unexpectedly high turnout, this primary election result suggests that that progressive forces are better positioned for November of 2024 than they were in 2020 or 2016. We might, I'm not saying this for sure, but might be headed toward a repeat of something like the 2012 election, in which Barack Obama swept Wisconsin. Tammy Baldwin was elected to the Senate. Democrats did very, very well in legislative voting, although they didn't get the majorities because of gerrymandering, but they did very, very well. And my suspicion is that if things keep going the way they are, this coalition has the potential to have a real impact, not just in Wisconsin, but similar coalitions in other battleground states across the country. So tracing back to these two referendums, we get evidence of what is possible politically. And that is an exciting thing, a good thing.
And what is possible is fulfillment by the people. So let me do the household duties, and then we'll get back to this very example, John. Folks, we need to make sure that if there's anyone out there, and most of you hear me always use, you're here, you're listening, you perhaps are here repeatedly, and even so, you might be mentioning to a friend or to a group such shows as We the People and other shows done by 100-plus programmers here at WPFW, bringing you jazz and justice for 47 years because you, the listener, support the station. I got very excited, told you we were doing well, but we even need to do better. It's not out of greed. It's not out of a sense of power. It's in solidarity with you. I, along with you, want to empower my community. I want to empower my family, my community, the nation, and possibly build a better world. You can do that by calling 800-222-9739, 800-222-9739, or make a pledge at WPFWFM.org, Cash App, $WPFWFM. All those ways are means that you can become a sustaining member, giving a little each month. Or if you're a person of means, you could really put us over the top, but know that you keep our momentum going. Momentum seems to be something of a thing nowadays. All this because it's people like you, like our founder Lou Hill, who decided that people will invest in their communities. They will invest in making lives better. Won't you become a member today? 1-800-222-9739. John Nichols, you mentioned what's going on in Wisconsin. There are many things in those dynamics. One, when people were presented with confusing language in those referendums, they went to each other and figured things out. Two, they had the courage to speak up to one another. Even under divisive politics, people saw that they had common needs. You talk about their concrete actions and their symbolism. Many years ago, you did a video called The Politics of Symbolism, where public government workers were pitted against each other. I wonder if you could quickly give that as an example, and then I'll let it lead to another point before we go.
Absolutely. Well, I'll do my best. Yeah, look, I mean, this is one of the things that's happening. It happens all the time. As you see social movements grow, and as organizing starts to pay off, as things start to come together, and you realize that you can have a change, you can have a fundamental change in this country, we can move in the right direction. The great majority of people want it. Then the right, frankly, and extreme forces on the right, respond to that by trying to divide that movement, right? They want to push people apart from one another. And one of the ways they've done it, I mean, they do it obviously along lines of race, gender, sexuality, so many other issues. But one of the ways they've done it is even within the trade union movement, they will say, well, you know, public sector workers somehow have an advantage over other workers. And so you ought to lower the wages of public sector workers, you ought to cut their benefits, make it harder for them to organize collectively or to bargain. And this is what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin more than a decade ago with the assaults on union rights, which many other Republicans do. It's frankly what Elon Musk and Donald Trump were talking about the other day on their live stream, you know, like bust up unions, undermine unions. And they'll use all sorts of divisive tactics. What we have to understand is we as individuals are not threatened when somebody else does well, right? They, you know, in among the working class, like if some workers get a decent contract, decent pay, as the UAW workers did, we should celebrate that and say we want some of that as well, instead of saying, oh, we don't want them to get what they got. And so this notion of working class solidarity and a broader solidarity between all the peoples who are, frankly, not in power, right? They aren't the billionaire class. They aren't the political elites. These are the people who actually make this country run on a daily basis. We have to be in solidarity. We have to recognize our connection to one another. And if we do, we have tremendous possibility to overcome, you know, right-wing policies, and also to do something very positive, which is to move this country in that direction of economic and social and racial justice through basic principles, not complex principles, basic ones, which we ought to be the baseline for everything. We ought to have economic justice for everyone. We ought to have social justice for everyone. We ought to have racial justice for everyone. And the additional elements that we put on, saving the planet, this is where we live. We don't want it to, you know, be destroyed. And ending wars, having peace, because violence, and particularly wars and imperialism, expansionist military initiatives, these draw away from our efforts to achieve economic and social and racial justice at home, and frankly, to have it internationally. So it's possible to do it, but we can't do it if we're divided. The right seeks to divide us. Our job is to refuse to be divided. That's what happened in Wisconsin with those referendums. Very big success. Happening right now, I think, in a lot of places with the energy around the Harris campaign. You know, it's very, very interesting to watch Kamala Harris run. Remember, she is the child of movement activists. She grew up going to demonstrations as a little girl. Anti-war demonstrations, civil rights demonstrations. She was a supporter of the farm workers in California, didn't eat a grape till she was an adult because of the grape boycotts. You know, this is a person who actually understands and gets movement politics. She doesn't make her always perfect. That's not to say she gets it perfectly now or she does everything right now. Plenty of people will have a critique, but she's got those roots. And if I can tell a quick story before you ask your last question, which I know will be brilliant. I've interviewed Kamala Harris a number of times in a lot of different settings. And what I can tell you about Kamala Harris is this. She is a very interesting and dynamic person. There's a lot more to her than a lot of the vapid media coverage has brought out. And she does have this history of growing up in the civil rights and anti-war movement. She also has a history of being a huge fan of jazz. I don't think any candidate for president has ever been even in the ballpark of being a jazz fan the way Kamala Harris is. She knows the artists. She buys the vinyl. She listens to jazz all the time. And her dad, John
Nichols,
bought her.
We're just about out of time. I'm sorry.
So but I'm just going to say, it circles it around to that concept of jazz and justice.
Well, thank you so much.
People should give money to this station.
Okay. Well, John Nichols of The Nation, we thank you for talking about pursuing the politics of hope. Listeners, I'm grateful that you have decided. Some anonymous listeners have put us over goal, but we need to keep going. do that by calling 1-800-222-9739. 1-800-222-9739. I thank you, along with staff and programmers, for listening. Coming up next is Don't Forget the Blues with Clarence the Blues Man Turner. As each show closes, you can continue your giving, whether it's by phone or online. And all I can say is, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for supporting WPFW. We continue in the struggle to make a better world, at least one broadcast at a time, together. Take good care.
Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Ukrainian forces say they've taken more ground in Russia's Kursk border region, capturing more than 100 Russian soldier prisoners and destroying a jet bomber. FSN's Simon Marks has more.
President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces now hold 1,000 square kilometers of Russian territory after launching a surprise attack on a border post on Ukraine's eastern front. Dr. Eleanor Bindman of Manchester Metropolitan University says Kyiv may be trying to seize territory to use as a bargaining chip in any peace talks with the Kremlin.
It's possible that that is one of the aims, and that the Ukrainians are trying to put themselves in a better position if it ever gets to the point that there are serious peace negotiations. Russia currently holds around 18% of Ukrainian territory, and it's been very clear that any negotiations would, you know, their starting point would be that they're not going to give up any of that territory. So the Ukrainians may be wanting to kind of, you know, come back with something stronger to say, well, we've got some of yours, so that's a sort of bargaining chip. I don't think ultimately that is really what's going to happen, because I think they probably will be forced to give it back. I think it's about boosting morale at home amongst the Ukrainian population, which is well over 2 years now into this brutal conflict.
This is the biggest incursion into Russian territory since the end of World War II. I'm Simon Marks.
Germany's issued a European arrest warrant against a Ukrainian who allegedly was part of a team that blew up the Nord Stream gas pipelines in the Black Sea, widely seen as an act of sabotage against Russia's invasion of Ukraine that resulted in the world's largest natural gas leak, emitting some 478,000 tons of methane into the atmosphere. Two other diving instructors are also suspects. Palestinian health officials say Israeli strikes across the Gaza Strip overnight and into today killed at least 20 people, including 5 children and their parents, as the death toll of Palestinian Gaza. Israel's weekend strike on a school in Gaza City that killed more than 100 Palestinians was a topic of a United Nations Security Council meeting Tuesday. Scott Baba reports.
The United States representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said that the United States was concerned over the reports of the Tabin school strike, while still defending Israel's right to defend itself.
Hamas continues to gather and continues to operate out of schools with no regard for the well-being of civilians.
Riyad Mansour, the permanent observer of Palestine to the United Nations, said that the killings over the weekend made it clear that Israel has no intention of listening to or obeying UN appeals, and called on the United Nations to pass binding sanctions against Israel.
Stop imagining that you can reason with the Israeli government so it stops killing civilians by the thousands, imposing famine, torturing prisoners, colonizing and annexing our land, all while you appeal to them.
Israeli Ambassador Gilad Erdin, whose country isn't a council member, excoriated the group for convening the urgent meeting about Saturday's airstrike.
We targeted dangerous terrorists.
I'm Scott Baba.